Recessional by James A. Michener. Copyright 1994 by James A. Michener. This recording of the full-length reading of Recessional was published by arrangement with James A. Michener and was produced in 1995 by Books on Tape Incorporated, which holds the copyright thereto. Neither this recording nor any part thereof may be reproduced or used for any purpose without prior written authority from Books on Tape Incorporated. This book is read by Larry A. McKeever. Recessional. Noun. A hymn or other piece of music played at the end of a service while the congregation is filing out. Chapter 1. Arrivals. On the last day of the year, when an icy blizzard shrieked in from Lake Michigan to cover Chicago in a coating of sleet, it struck with particular fury at Boul' Miche', the handsome thoroughfare that displays the best of the Windy City. Here stood the enormously rich Art Institute, the great hotels to which Middle America came to participate in metropolitan life. Business men and women came to visit banks and centers of commerce, shoppers to patronize the elegant stores, others to enjoy the fine museums. Michigan Boulevard was the official name of the spacious promenade, but early Chicagoans, deeming their city the equal of any in Europe, had informally christened their major street Boul' Miche' in the French style, and the name had stuck. In summer, the long stretches that faced the lake, with only parkland between the boulevard and the water, seemed almost rural. But on this dark December morning, with the blizzard whipping in, Boul' Miche' was a formidable place that only the brave dared challenge. Sleet had encrusted everything, its scintillating gleam rivaling that of the jewels on display in the shop windows. It lay so heavy on the boulevard, and was accompanied by such a powerful blast from the lake, that ropes had been strung between poles to enable pedestrians to crawl along without being blown into the storefronts or out into the traffic. Some hardy men seemed to revel in the hazards of the storm, striding purposefully along as if impervious to the menace underfoot. But even they, when a gust roared in without warning, were quick to grasp at the protective ropes and edge their way along. Women, their coats and dresses whipping about their knees, retreated to the safe streets that ran parallel to Boul' Miche' but inland from the lake, Wabash, State, or Dearborn, where walking became easier with careful navigation of the sleeted pavements. At half after nine on this wintry morning, a slim young man in his middle thirties worked his way carefully southward along Boul' Miche'. When he tried to negotiate the Monroe Cross Street, he was driven so far to his right that he found himself completely off the boulevard. But with extra effort he worked his way back, relieved to find himself protected by the massive bulk of the Art Institute. "I never visited you enough," he apologized to the entrance as he paused to catch his breath. "And now I won't have the chance. Damn." With renewed strength, he left the protection of the museum. Pulling the lapels of his overcoat more tightly about his throat, and holding them there with his right hand, he managed to cling to the rope with his left and work his way along the boulevard to Van Buren and then to Congress, where the line of luxury hotels began. By the time he reached the Sparkman Towers, he was so exhausted that he did not enter like a normal guest through the main entrance, but allowed the wind to push him through the small side door, the only one kept open during such storms. Safely indoors, he dropped momentarily into an upholstered chair to regain control of his heartbeat and breathing. Taking his pulse, as he always did after heavy exertion, he nodded with satisfaction. 110, dropping rapidly to good old 80. After a few minutes, he felt ready for the crucial meeting he had come for. But before he could find the receptionist, he was accosted by the hotel doorman, who had been sensible enough to move his workstation inside and away from the blizzard. "Pretty bad out there?" He was a jovial fellow in his 50s, overweight, but also over-endowed with Irish charm and a winning smile, the kind of man who created the impression that he took pride in his work. It's a gangbuster. If they hadn't strung the ropes, I'd never have made it. And who might you be coming to see on a morning like this? John Taggart. I believe he's expecting me. On a Saturday morning like this? I suspect he's as eager to see me as I am to see him, storm or no storm. And who can I say wants to see him? Andy Zorn. Dr. Andy Zorn. A medical doctor? Don't tell me you make house calls. Only on nice days like this when I enjoy the walk. The doorman led the way to the small, handsomely decorated table that served as the reception desk. Dr. Andy Zorn to see Mr. Taggart. Says he has an appointment. He does indeed, the young woman in the trim business suit said. Mr. Taggart called a few minutes ago, said he was expecting you, but he doubted you could make it in this storm. Said to bring you right up, Dr. Zorn. She accompanied him to the bank of 8 elevators, choosing a reserved one for which she had a special key. John Taggart, a major Chicago investor in retirement centers across the country, maintained both his living quarters and his office, two different sets of rooms, on the 23rd floor of the towers. The door to his apartment contained only its number, 2300. His office carried no number at all, only a small brass plate affixed to the wall, engraved with elegant letters so small they could scarcely be read from a distance. John Taggart Enterprises. The receptionist did not knock on the office door, but entered as if the place was familiar, leading Zorn to an inner sanctuary. Behind a large white oak desk sat a 50-year-old man in an elegant exercise suit, heavily ribbed gray turtleneck sweater, and fitted trousers in a gray one shade darker. Surprisingly, he wore about his forehead a rough terry cloth sweatband, which he did not take off as he rose and extended his hand to welcome Dr. Zorn. When I looked out this morning and saw the blizzard, I said, "He won't make it today," and went down to the gym for my workout. He pressed his hands proudly over his flat stomach. "But it was essential that I see you," Zorn said, as Mr. Taggart accompanied the receptionist to the door and said, "Thank you so much, Beth, for bringing him up." Turning back to Zorn, he said, "Yes, it is important, isn't it? For both of us." For the next moments, Taggart simply stared at his visitor. The vacancy in his huge organization was of supreme importance, and the new manager would have to be a youngish man of exceptional abilities. Tampa was the flagship of Taggart Enterprises, but it was foundering. What Taggart saw in his inspection of a man he had not previously met was a doctor of 35, medium height, not overweight, in apparent good health, and distinguished by two attractive qualities. He had a healthy crop of brick-red hair, which looked as if it ought to be accompanied by a face full of country boy freckles, and a roguish smile that signaled, "I don't take myself too seriously." Taggart knew that he had been a successful medical doctor of great ability who had fallen on bad times and had left his profession. Zorn was available to direct a major health institution, and Taggart wanted to hire him, but needed to know what kind of man he was after the buffetings he'd taken. Indicating that Zorn should take the preferred seat, the one that looked out on Lake Michigan, he said, "Have you had breakfast?" When Zorn nodded yes, he said, "Good, so have I. But I'll bet we could each profit from some fresh-squeezed orange juice." Pushing a button on his desk intercom, he ordered the drinks. And before they arrived, he went directly to the heart of the problem that had brought them together. "We need each other, Zorn. From what my men tell me, I judge that you're fed up with...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?